The following is a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
I invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 2. It's the last time I'll ask you to turn to Ecclesiastes, chapter 2, for a while. So please turn to the second chapter of Ecclesiastes. Do you love your job? Do you love your work? I love my job as a pastor. I have to confess, as some of you know, I never thought I'd be a pastor. God has a sense of humor and has a way of changing our plans. When I was in college, plan A was to be a medical doctor. And so I went through 4 years of college and planned to go into the medical field. And God has a way of changing your plans. And that door shut. And so I went to plan B, and that was physical therapy. And didn't have a desire for that after some time, and so I changed to plan C, and that was to teach aviation physiology in the Air Force. Well, about 2 years into that job, I realized that God had a plan D that I never anticipated. Having saved me in college, He then brought us to a church where we are equipped and trained to do the work of the ministry, and now I wouldn't trade it for anything. People ask me sometime today, what do you do? I say, I'm a pastor. They say, do you like your job? And I say, it's the best job, and it's the hardest job. And it's the hardest job because, as you know, it's just hard. The weight and the pressure of ministry is always there, and the preaching of the Word and the teaching of God's Word is always there, the pressure of that, and dealing with my own sin and other people's sin. It's a weighty task, and so I have to confess that there are days when I think it'd be better just to go and pound nails. Just be a carpenter and just whack a hammer. That just sounds so much better. Or, I always thought it'd be great to be a mailman. To me, that just sounds wonderful. You get to walk all day. You get paid to walk from house to house and deliver the mail and just be outside. That just sounds wonderful to me. Maybe it's not, but it sounds wonderful to me some days. But on the whole, I love my job. I love what I do. I love my work. It's still the best job in the world to be able to teach God's word, to shepherd God's people, and to be a part of leading His church. What about you? Do you love your work? Do you love your job? It's an important question to ask because work is hard. Labor is difficult, and we live under the curse of work, and we're reminded of that on a regular basis, aren't we? Someone has once said that hard work never killed anybody, but why take a chance? Someone else has said, I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. Someone else has said, hard work spotlights the character of people. Some turn up their sleeves, some turn up their noses, and some don't turn up at all. It was Abraham Lincoln who said, my father taught me to work, but he did not teach me to love it. Work is hard. Work is difficult. It's been estimated that you and I will spend a third of our lives working. From the 20s to the 60s or longer for some of us, 40 to 60 hours a week, we will work. Some of you are working now outside the home. You're in a factory, you're in an office. Some of you are working inside the home, which, by the way, is a full-time job. If you ever wondered, it is difficult work. And work comes with its own set of problems. It comes with its own set of difficulties and trouble. And the question we must ask ourselves is, can work provide the satisfaction that we're after? It's an important question to ask and to answer because many people find their identity in their work. They find their sense of purpose, their sense of meaning, their sense of satisfaction in work, in their job. And we know that because one of the first questions that's ever asked of someone when we meet someone is, what do you do? Where do you work? What kind of career, profession are you in? We are, in a sense, defined by our work. The question is, will it give us the purpose? Will it give us the satisfaction? Will it give us the joy and the meaning that we are all after? If you have been with us the last few weeks, you know that this is the question that Solomon researched. He was looking for satisfaction in life. Solomon went looking for something to satisfy him, something to give him some sense of purpose, something to give him some meaning in his life. The richest, wisest, most famous, most prominent man ever to live, save Christ, conducted this grand experiment to find something, anything that would satisfy him. And the problem with his study, the problem with his research, was it was conducted under the sun. It was conducted under heaven, meaning it wasn't conducted with a view towards God. God was not in the picture. And so God never came into his consideration as he's seeking for satisfaction. His experiment purposely excluded God. And so as we've seen over the last 7-8 weeks, Solomon has gone searching for satisfaction in wisdom. He first sought to use the wisdom God gave him to find some satisfaction, and he found that empty. So he went after entertainment, and he went after pleasure, and he went after comedy and laughter, thinking that maybe that would give him some form of satisfaction and joy, and that too was empty. He went after drinking. He went looking for life in a bottle, and that was empty. He went looking for life in stuff and possessions and things, and that was vanity. He went looking for life in money, to see if money would satisfy his soul, and that was empty. And he went looking for life in sex, and that too was empty. And you'd think by this point that Solomon, the wisest man who's ever lived, would start to get a clue. You'd think that he'd start to figure out that all of these things that he's pursuing wind up in a dead-end street. But Solomon's not willing to give up his search yet. He's got one last-ditch effort to find something other than God to satisfy his soul, and so he turns to work. He explores the possibility that hard work can somehow satisfy his soul and bring him the satisfaction that he's after. Maybe if he just puts his nose to the grindstone, Solomon can find some level of satisfaction. You're going to see this morning his conclusion. And we need to hear this conclusion. You and I need to hear this because every single one of us here today is involved in some form of labor. Whether at your job, whether in your home, whether outside your home, every single one of us is involved in some form of labor and work. And the question is, can that and will that satisfy us to the level that we're hoping that it will? Let me just give you some thoughts as we jump into this, just some theological foundations upon which we can build. The first one is that we need to understand that work is not a result of the curse. And some people think that's true. Some people think that their work and their labor is a result of what took place in Genesis 3, that it's a result of the fall of man and sin entering the world. But we need to understand that God gave Adam and Eve work to do before the fall. In Genesis 1, verse 28, God says, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it and rule over it." He says to Adam and Eve, "You've got to work. In this perfect creation where there's no sin, you're going to work and you're going to rule and you're going to subdue this creation." He gave them work to do before sin ever entered the world. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, it says, "Then the Lord took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it." The word cultivate is a word that means to work, to engage in labor, to put forth toil. And so God has designed work to be something that took place prior to the fall. Before sin ever entered in the world, God has designed for there to be work. And so it's good. Work is good. He's designed us to be made in the image of God. And so part of that is working according to his honor and to his glory. And so work is not a curse. The curse of work is that it's more difficult than what it was designed to be. But work itself is good. Added to this fact is the fact that God actually commands us to work. In Exodus chapter 20, verses 9 and 10, you know this, it says, "6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God." So work is created by God, and he commands us to engage in work. In fact, did you know this, that the work week is made after God's initial creation week? The reason we work for 6 days and rest one is because God worked for 6 days and rested one. We're to work. We're made to work. In fact, if we don't work, there are instructions in Scripture against laziness and against not working diligently. In Proverbs 6, warns against laziness. He says, "Go to the ant and look at these who work so diligently." In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, he says, "Those of you who are leading an undisciplined life and doing no work at all are to get to work. Because if you don't work, you don't eat." So God has made us to work. He's created us to work. He's commanded us to work. But Work won't satisfy us. Work won't provide the satisfaction, the meaning, the purpose in life that we are looking for. It won't give us the gratification, the fulfillment, the hope that we're looking for in this life. It won't give us the pleasure that only God can give us. And so those of us who look to work to provide some lasting satisfaction need to hear from the wisest man who's ever lived and his conclusions on the futility of work. You need to think kind of with two hats this morning. One, work is good. Work is designed by God. Work is ordained by God. On the other hand, work apart from God with no view towards God won't satisfy you. It won't give you any pleasure. You know that. Work's hard. Some of you have difficult bosses. Some of you have difficult employees. Some of you have difficult people to work alongside. Some of you work in a work environment which is just monotonous and tedious. Some of you work in an environment where there's little morale. Some of you work for a company whose ethical standards are suspect. Some of you are working in an environment where there's little or no job security. The threat of unemployment is there. Some of you live in an environment and work in an environment where there's a threat of underemployment. These are all the problems and the difficulties and the hardships associated with work. Philip Ryken says this. He says, every time we get sick and tired of doing the same thing over and over, every time we are inconvenienced by someone else's laziness or incompetence, every time our families suffer from the demands of our employer, every time we are pressured to practice business unethically, we are struggling with the vanity of work. End quote. There is a futility and a frustration and a toilsome weariness that comes with work. And so Solomon's going to tell us today that it's the wrong place to find satisfaction. It's the wrong place to find joy. And here's a man who probably never had to deal with rush hour traffic, right? Here's a man who probably didn't have an unfair boss or never had to work for a commission or never had to work with those awful crowds on Black Friday, right? And yet, here's a man who came to understand that work itself is futile and vain and meaningless when you take God out of the picture. We're going to see that today in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 12 to 26. We're going to take a big section today. We are going to move a little more quickly. Some of you don't think this can be done. It can be done, I promise you, because we're going to skim verses 12 to 17, because we've already looked at this topic already. In verses 12 to 17, Solomon looks at the futility of wisdom. We've looked at this already back in chapter 1. Let me just highlight some of the same things that he says here in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 12. He says, I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? So here Solomon again turns to wisdom. He started his test with wisdom. He turns to his test of wisdom one more time. Verse 13. And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. He says there is a value to wisdom. It is better to see in the light than be blinded by the darkness. So there is some wisdom, there is some value to having wisdom as light excels darkness. However, look at the problem. Verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I know that one fate befalls them all. Befalls them both. And I said to myself in verse 15, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. See what he's saying? He's saying, yeah, it's good to be wise. There's benefits to wisdom, but it doesn't matter if you're wise or you're a fool. Either way, you're going to die. And then it doesn't matter. Death is that great equalizer that levels the playing field. Every person ultimately will die. If you're a fool, you'll die. If you're wise, you'll die. Verse 16. For there's no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, and as much as in the coming days, all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die. Listen, it doesn't matter if you live a wise life or a foolish life, in a sense. Because you're going to die. And in a generation from now, no one's going to remember you. And in two generations from now or three generations from now, your name's going to be totally forgotten. So it doesn't matter if you were a wise person or a foolish person in that sense. You're going to die and your name's going to be forgotten. So verse 17, he says, I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. He says, I'm looking at everything I've done. All the work that I've poured myself into, looking for life in this and that, and building these things and engaging in all this labor, it's all futile. Striving after the wind. In fact, it's so bad, I hate life and the work which I have been doing. This launches Solomon into a description of the futility of work. And I want you to notice that in verses 18 to 24, the word labor or labored occurs at least 11 times. Verse 18, it occurs twice. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Verse 19, it occurs twice. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I labored by acting wisely. Verse 20, it occurs twice. I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Do you see it? Over and over and over again in this chapter, he's talking about labor, work, toil, your job. He's going to tell us that it's all futile. The thing you do 40, 60 hours a week, it's all empty. It's all meaningless. You're thinking, thank you. Finally, someone telling me what I come to know. It's all empty. When you consider it from the secular perspective. All right, now mark this in your minds. There is a value to work. In fact, we're going to see that here in just a few minutes. And you've got to understand that when we come to the end of this passage, you're in for a surprise. Okay, you're in for a treat. There is something at the end of this passage that will shock you. But here's what you need to understand first. Work is futile, empty, meaningless. Let me substantiate that for you. Let me give you three evidences that work, without reference to God, is futile. Three evidences. I want to prove to you, and Solomon's going to prove to us, that work without reference to God is empty, meaningless, and vanity. Number one, here's the first evidence that work without reference to God is futile. Number one, the recipients of your labor may squander it. Here's Solomon's first evidence, his first point to justify the fact that if you labor and you work, you've got to understand that everything you earn and everything you work for could one day go to a fool. Verse 18. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. He says, I hated it. I hated my job. Can you relate to that? I hated my work. I hate everything that took place, everything that happened as a result of this labor under the sun. There's the key phrase. Mark that, highlight it, circle it. I hated all the labor, the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. That's his way of saying without reference to God, without thinking about God, without putting God into the equation of my work, I hated it. Why? Here's why, verse 18, he tells us, here's the first reason. For, or because, I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And the word leave there carries with it the idea of bequeathing, or giving to, or donating, or willing to someone. It's the idea of when you die, you give to them what you have. And he says, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Everything you've worked for, everything you've earned, all your hard labor, everything you've accumulated for yourself, all the results of your labor will go to someone else after you die. You ever think about that? Can't take it with you. You're going to leave it all behind. I mean, you may lose it before you die. The stock market may crash, and so you may lose it before you die, but you're certainly going to lose it all when you die. Eventually, everything you've worked for in your lifetime will go to someone else. You ever think about that? I want you to think just for a moment at the moment when someone pronounces you dead. coming. A doctor will call out your time of death. Every single one of us will have that called out. Kind of a morbid thought, isn't it? And at that moment, everything you own will go to another person. Your bank account, your portfolio that you've so carefully accumulated over the years will be managed by someone else. Your contents of your home will be thrown open to an estate sale, and people will walk in and scavenge everything from your home. Your clothes will be given to Goodwill. All your collections of things and trinkets that you've arrayed in that beautiful curio cabinet in your living room will be gone, sent to someone else. You're going to leave it all behind. You're saying, Todd, aren't you supposed to come to church to be encouraged and kind of built up? Here's the real problem. Look at verse 19. He says, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. You see what he's saying here? And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. When you die, all your stuff, all your things, everything you've worked for is going to go to someone else. And you have no guarantee that that person will be wise or that person will be a fool. Everything you have amassed over a lifetime, everything you've worked for so diligently, everything you've accumulated is going to go to someone else. And that person could be wise, or that person could be foolish. Verse 19, he says, that person will have control over the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely. See what he's saying? He's saying, for all my life I've been a wise man, and I've been shrewd, and I've been sensible, and I've been wise in how I've handled my things. And because of God's blessing upon me, I've accumulated a bunch of stuff, and I've built all this stuff, this empire, and I've worked for all these things. I've been wise. But another person's going to come along who's going to control that. They're going to exercise dominion over it. They're going to get all his stuff, and they're going to have complete power and authority and dominion over everything that he has worked for. And this thought devastated Solomon. It caused him to despair to the point that he says at the end of verse 19, this too is vanity. Emptiness. It's fleeting. It's your breath on a cold winter morning that's here and then it's gone. That's it. It's vanity. Did you know that this is exactly what happened in Solomon's case? His worst fears were realized in his own son. Solomon's son was named Rehoboam. And in 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 21 to 26, and leading up to that in chapters 12 and chapter 13, it tells us how wicked his son Rehoboam was. This was a wicked man. He was a foolish man. He made the work of the tribes of Israel more difficult. He didn't lessen the load. He made it more difficult. He was a tyrant. He was a fool. In fact, the kingdom was divided under Rehoboam's rule. Northern tribes, southern tribes. He only maintained control of one tribe. All the other tribes went with the northern kingdom. He was a fool. Everything Solomon had worked for was shot. 1 Kings chapter 14, listen. It says, it happened in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. And he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. So Solomon's amassed this wealth. He's amassed everything that he has built up in his kingdom. And here, suddenly, after his death, Rehoboam, his foolish and wicked son, loses it all to the king of Egypt. This is the futility of work. You see, it's maybe easier to stomach if we know that all of our possessions and everything we've worked for would go to someone that we loved and respected. But we can never be sure of that even after we die. We don't have that guarantee. So friends, you need to understand that this is the nature of work apart from a godly perspective. This is the nature of work when you take God out of the equation and you just throw yourself into your work looking for some form of satisfaction. At some point, you're going to come to the realization, it's not even mine to keep. And it may go to a fool. Friends, do you realize this? Do you realize that everything you're working for today could fall into the hands of someone else tomorrow? And it will. If you're looking for satisfaction in your work, you need to know that everything you're working for could eventually wind up in the hands of fools. Number two, there's another problem with work. It's that the beneficiaries of your labor have not earned it. And so one problem, the first problem that Solomon told us about, is that the recipients of your labor may squander it. But there's a second problem associated with your labor, and it is that the beneficiaries of your labor have not earned it. Even if the person who gets all your stuff is wise, they haven't done anything to get it. Look at verse 20. Solomon says, therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Here's Solomon. He's at the point of despair. He's hopeless. He says, I have turned aside my heart to despair. I have completely despaired. I'm in misery. I'm in anguish over the thought of the futility of my work. Why? Why is he so in despair over this? What's the big deal? I mean, Solomon, it's just stuff. It's just your legacy. Why are you so worked up about this? Verse 21, here it is. Here's the second reason. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. Here's the problem. Everything you've worked for will go to someone who has not even worked for it. Everything you've worked for, everything you've gained, everything you've thrown yourself into, all those hours at the office, all the work that you've engaged in will result in someone else getting it. And they haven't lifted a finger to do anything to get it. Notice how he describes himself here in this verse. He says, a man who has labored with wisdom and knowledge and skill. That's probably a reference to himself. That's how he conducted himself. He did labor with wisdom and knowledge and skill. You remember everything Solomon built? I mean, he built the temple. He built the king's house. He built these beautifully terraced parks and forests and trees. And he had ponds all over the place. And he built strategic military cities. And he built these strategic storehouse cities where food was stored. He built the Milo, which was this beautiful garden. He conducted himself with wisdom and skill and knowledge. He was the world's most successful businessman ever to walk the face of the planet. But Solomon would have to leave it to someone who never even contributed anything to all his labor. Everything he worked so hard for would go to someone who hadn't done anything, hadn't contributed anything, and yet they would get this inheritance. Look what he says at the end of verse 21. He says, this too is vanity and a great evil. He calls this evil. This is empty. This is absolutely futile. You spend your life working this hard. You spend your life engaging in this much activity. You immerse yourself into your labor. You spend all these years, decades of your life, throwing yourself into this work, toiling and sweating and blood, sweat, and tears into this work. And in the end, you just give it to someone else who did nothing. He says, that's wicked. That's unfair. That's futile. You realize no one tells you this when you're working, right? When you sign up with your employer, you don't sign a contract that says, and you know, by the way, that there's going to come a point when you die and all this stuff that you've earned is going to go to someone else. No one tells you this. Everyone tells you to work hard, be a faithful employee, be diligent, get a good pension, build up enough for retirement. Those are all good things. But no one ever tells you, you'll just end up giving it to someone else who hasn't worked for any of it. You realize this? I think deep down, each one of us wants our lives to count for something, don't we? We want to have this knowledge that we'll leave a legacy, we'll bequeath to our people who come after us this great legacy of godliness, which is excellent, and we'll bequeath to them this wonderful treasures and things in this life that we've accumulated, and we'll spend our whole life accumulating things. But here's the reality. You're not going to take it with you. It's going to be passed on to someone else who hasn't worked for it, who hasn't deserved it, and hasn't earned it. Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, he wrote about this. Listen to what he says. He says, "My question, that which at the age of 50 brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions, lying in the soul of every man, a question without an answer to which one cannot live. It was this: what will come of what I am doing today or tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed this way: is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting for me does not destroy?" End quote. He had the same question. What's the meaning of all this? What's all this for? What's going to happen to all this? Friends, listen, this is a warning for anyone who's trying to work and labor and be diligent to accumulate stuff. And by the way, it's also a warning for anyone who is immersing themselves into their work in the hopes of finding some level of satisfaction. Listen, all you workaholics, look up. Listen, you are throwing yourself into something. You are ambitious to achieve something. It is futile. It's empty. What are you working for? Say, "Todd, this is pretty depressing." It's okay. It gets worse. Number three. Watch this. The pain of your labor shows the futility of it. Okay, so it's bad enough that you leave behind everything that you have, not knowing whether it goes to a wise person or a foolish person. That's bad. But it gets worse. Secondly, we saw that it's bad. It's bad because you leave it to someone who doesn't deserve it. But work itself, here, number three, work itself is toil, trouble, painful, difficult, wearisome. The pain of your labor itself shows the futility of it. Look at verse 22. "For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving which he labors under the sun?" Here's a rhetorical question. He's coming to the point where he says, what do you get? You labor, you toil, you strive, you throw yourself into your work. And what do you get? Nothing. You work. You labor, you toil. And what do you get? Nothing. Oh, wait, you get something. Look at verse 23. "Because all his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest." This is what you get. You get something. You get pain. You get sorrow. You get weariness. In fact, it's so bad, there are going to be nights where you lay in your bed and you can't even sleep. That's what you get. Will that minister to your soul? It's exhausting physically. It's exhausting mentally. Work is hard, it's painful, it's wearisome, it's grueling, it's arduous, it's tiring. And you know why that's the case? It's that case because the sin of the world, the sin of Adam and Eve, has corrupted work. God has created it to be good. He's designed it to be good. He's designed it to be profitable. He's designed it to be something to be enjoyed and engaged in and worked in and given Him glory for. But sin came into the world. Remember what God says to Adam back in Genesis chapter 3? God curses the serpent. He curses Satan. He curses Eve. He says to Adam this, Genesis 3:17, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. And you will eat the plants of the field, by the sweat of your face you will eat bread." God said, "You can still get food from the ground, Adam, but it's going to be a lot harder. It's going to be much more painful. You have to sweat. You have to work much more diligently than if you had, if sin hadn't entered into the world." In fact, did you know the word painful, toil, in Genesis 3:17 is the same word as pain in Genesis 3:16, referring to a wife giving birth? The same pain you have, ladies, in giving birth to your children is the pain that men will endure in their work. Think about all the toil, all the pain, all the sorrow that work brings you. Sometimes you worry about not having enough work, right? You're underemployed. You don't have enough to stay busy. Sometimes you have so much work, you wonder if you can even get it done. And sometimes you're laying in bed and you're sleepless. You're there and you're trying to figure out all these things and you're trying to wrestle through how do you handle this, and you're stressed out and you're anxious. So the biggest thing you need that night is a good night of rest, and you can't even get that because work is so toilsome. You add to that the monotony of your work, the difficulty of your work, the tediousness of your work, the repetitious nature of your work. It's just so meaningless. My first job was in a blueberry farm. I was excited. 8th grade. You know, couldn't wait to get my first paycheck. So I show up at the blueberry farm and they say, "This is your job. Your job is to pick blueberries and put them in a bucket. And when the bucket's full, you come and we'll give you another bucket." I can do that. So I grab my bucket and I go out to the blueberry field and I start picking blueberries. 2 hours later, I had half a full bucket of blueberries. So I worked another 2 hours and I got more blueberries and I got those and brought them back to the place and where they hired me, and I said, "Here's my blueberries." They said, "Great, congratulations. Here's 50 cents. Monotonous. Tedious. I quit. I said, "This is for the birds. You're kidding me. I'm going to labor for 4 hours for a bucket of blueberries and get 50 cents. So I went and got a job at an onion factory. And my job was to move bags of onions from this place to this place. 8 hours a day. I said, "This is ridiculous." I quit. My father-in-law asked me when I asked to marry his daughter whether I could hold down a job. Work is like that. It's monotonous, tedious, mind-numbing. Oh, and by the way, you want to know how long it lasts? Look at verse 23. How long does this last? "Because all his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest." How long does this last? Forever. Till you die. You're going to do this day after day after day after week after month after year after decade. You're going to do this till you die. How's that for encouraging? Futile. The 6 dwarfs in Snow White got it right, didn't they? "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work, we 7 dwarfs. There were only 6 on the log when they said it. Check it out. I promise. We'll debate it later, I promise. They said, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go." And you do it day after day, after week, after year. Solomon says a third time in verse 23, it's vanity. He said it once, it's vanity. He said it twice, it's vanity. Verse 23, this too is vanity. Empty, meaningless, futile. You understand that this is the nature of work without God in the picture. You just go and slug it out. You put your nose to the grindstone. You become a workaholic and you throw yourself into your work. Friends, you're going to end up in great disappointment. Your soul's going to be empty. Your satisfaction will be lacking. And if you make work your life, your soul will shrivel up and die. Are you looking for life in work? You better be pretty depressed at this point. Because this is pretty depressing stuff. And I'm imagining some of you at this point are just saying, "Fine, I'll go home and I'll just sit. I'll resign." If that's what you're feeling, good. Because Solomon's point is to drive you to the Lord. And for you to see work in light of God. Watch this. Remember I said there's a surprise? This is amazing. Verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? Wait, is this the same guy? You gotta be kidding. This is the same guy who just wrote verses 18 to 23? He sounds schizophrenic. This guy needs counseling. Make up your mind, Solomon. Which one is it? He is trying here to figure out, how do you make sense of this whole thing? And he comes to the realization that he has been looking at work from a secular perspective. He's starting to get it. The veil is starting to be pulled back in Solomon's understanding. And he's beginning to get it, that he's been looking at it all the wrong way. Work, when considered without God, is everything we've talked about. It's futile, it's empty, it's meaningless, it's vain. But when God's in the picture, it changes everything. Suddenly your work becomes a place of hope and joy. It becomes something as a means to worship God. What's taking place here? I mean, is Solomon speaking out of two sides of his mouth? On the one hand, he's saying it's so futile and so empty and so meaningless. On the other hand, he's saying, but it's good and you're to enjoy it. I mean, which one is it, Solomon? Well, Solomon's not confused. Solomon's holding these twin themes up, and we need to preach both of them and hold them both to be true. Yes, on the one hand, work is futile. On the other hand, when God is the source of your joy and you view work as a gift from Him, it takes on all new meaning. God makes all the difference in this. And that's his point here in verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and to drink and to tell himself that his labor is good. Why? This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. You see, up to this point, Solomon has really not even considered God. God's only mentioned one time in chapter 1, verse 13, and there he seems to be part of the problem. But now, God's presence makes all the difference. The presence of God, the gift of God, the glory of God suddenly takes on all new understanding here in this understanding of work. See, Solomon's starting to get it. He's starting to understand. He's learning that earthly pleasures are a gift from God. He's starting to see that work can be enjoyed in and work can be engaged in with great delight, because it's from the hand of God. Solomon's point here is, you can turn work, which is futile and meaningless from a secular perspective, into a means by which we worship and thank God. You say, how do you do that? It's a matter of perspective. You see, if you're in your job to climb the corporate ladder, to make a name for yourself, to scramble for raises and promotions, you're going to experience the futility and the meaninglessness of work. Or you can work with an attitude of thankfulness to God and do your work heartily as unto Him, and you'll know joy. Look at verse 25. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? Who's the Him? That's God. You see what he's saying? God is the source of our joy. He's the source of our pleasure. He's the source of our encouragement. He's our hope. And so you can take something that's mundane and tedious and empty and futile, like work, and it can become a source of joy and meaningfulness to you when you view that from the hand of God, who's the source of all joy. I got to ask you this morning, do you have joy in life? Do you have joy in life? Because if you don't, Solomon nails the problem right here. If you are lacking joy, friend, it's because you don't understand where true joy comes from. It comes from God. Psalm 16:11, in your presence is fullness of joy, and at your right hand there are pleasures forever. They're knowing God. It's walking with God. That's where you'll find enjoyment. That's where you'll find hope. But if you live like Solomon, if you live outside of God's purview, if you look to your circumstances and your life without a view towards God, you're going to have little or no joy. So how do you find your enjoyment in work? You work under the S-O-N, not the S-U-N. That will radically change your perspective. And by the way, this is consistent with what the New Testament teaches. Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, slaves in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. It's the Lord Christ whom you serve. Is Christ your boss? If he is, you'll work in such a way that he gets the glory and you get the joy. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 to 7 say, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh in the sincerity of your heart as to Christ, not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ with goodwill render service to the Lord. Friends, God is your boss. In the home, outside the home, in your office, God's your boss. So you see what Solomon's saying here? He's saying, love your work. Is it futile? Yep. Meaningless? Yep. Vain? Yep. Love it. Because you use it as a means to worship God. And you use it as a means, as a platform by which to give Him thanks. Look how he drives this point home in verse 26. For to a person who is good in his sight, he has wisdom. He has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner, he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. There are two kinds of people. There is one person who pleases God and there is the sinner. And the one who pleases God, he says, God will honor him. God will bless him. And you will find enjoyment in your labor. Or you can be the sinner who just works and works and gathers and collects. And if you're that person, there's coming a day when you give it to somebody else. Look, he says at the end of verse 26, so that he may give it to one who is good in God's sight. Two ways to live. You do your work as unto the Lord. Use it as a means to worship and glorify Him, or you work for yourself, making a name for yourself, gathering and collecting, and in the end, you will give it to someone else. Friends, the difference in this whole discussion is God. How's your view of God? If you are here today and you are lacking joy in your life, maybe it's because God is not the blazing center of your universe. And if He's not, you're not going to have joy. But if He is, you're going to view everything. What you do in your home, what you do in the office, what you do in the factory, as a means to glorify Him, as an expression of His gift to you. Friends, this is a charge for us as a church to be radically God-centered. Are you? Do you live that way? Do you find enjoyment in the gifts that God gives you? Do you enjoy your work? Do you enjoy what God has given you every day? Do you enjoy eating and drinking to the glory of God? He's the giver of good gifts. So Solomon says, love your work. Throw yourself into it. For the glory of God. It's really the perfect post-Thanksgiving message, isn't it? As we realize who the giver of all gifts really is. Father, I want to thank you for this. In a seemingly obscure portion of the Old Testament, that there's rich, rich truth. God, let us see you as the source of all gifts. Let us worship you as the giver of all good things. Lord, let us remember that true enjoyment comes from you and nothing else. We're not going to find it in the bottle. We're not going to find it in pleasure. We're not going to find it in things or money or wisdom or education or sex. We're going to find true enjoyment in you. So Lord, let us run to you. Let us run to the cross of Christ where this joy was purchased for us. Let us live with you as the blazing hot center of our universe, that we may live and work to the honor and the glory of Christ. In whose name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a sermon by Pastor Todd Dykstra, teaching pastor of Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.